This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Joy Drive on Joy 94.9 FM in Melbourne, Joy on your digital radio, iHeartRadio, TuneIn.com or the Joy app. No matter where you are, you can always take Em and Warren with you.
18 minutes past four.
Mental ill health reached new heights during the pandemic. COVID also created unprecedented demand for mindfulness apps and online courses. Mindfulness is part of the trillion-dollar wellness industry, with smartphone apps skyrocketing in popularity and seeming to offer incredible promise for low cost. But how effective are these mindfulness smartphone apps? Nicholas Van Dam, Associate Professor and Director of the Contemplative Studies Centre at Melbourne University, joins us to discuss. Welcome to Joy Drive, Nicholas.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Firstly, what is mindfulness exactly?
So mindfulness is something that can be a bit hard to pin down. So there's a very commonly used definition that Jon Kabat-Zinn, who's kind of the father of Western mindfulness. So Jon Kabat-Zinn says that it's awareness that arises through paying attention on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally. And so what he means basically is, by focusing on something, you become aware of things. But critically, you have to go out of your way to do it. So it's not just something that happens to you accidentally. He says that it's something that you're kind of aware of what you're doing right now. So that's that present moment bit. It's not, you know, what I had for lunch yesterday or what I'm going to have for dinner tonight. And this non-judgmental element is also a critical attitude that you bring to it, which doesn't mean that you just accept whatever happens. What it means is that you're open to experience. You're open to kind of feeling whatever it is that you feel and figuring out how to best work with that. So that's a definition that kind of gets commonly used, and it's one that I think works reasonably well.
Nick, what about research? What does that show in terms of mindfulness having in terms of mental health benefits?
So the most research that we have is focused on what we'd call mindfulness-based programs. And these are the kind of first things that came out in the space. They really originated in the 1980s, coming largely out of the US. And these were akin to group psychotherapy programs. So they ran for about 8 weeks. People would meet as a group of about, you know, 8 to 12 people with a facilitator, usually for 2 to 3 hours a week. And then they were encouraged to practice on their own for upwards of 45 minutes a day. And included in that was a 1 day, about 6 to 8 hour semi-meditation retreat. So, you know, that sounds pretty intensive relative to us talking about apps. But those programs work pretty well. They help people with anxiety, depression, stress, a number of various conditions. They don't necessarily work better than standard talk psychotherapy, but they do work quite well. Now, when we move into the newer versions of mindfulness and meditation, when we start talking about online programs and apps, what we know is substantially less. We have a lot fewer studies, but what we do have suggests that there may still be effects, but they're nowhere near as pronounced. So the benefits are a lot smaller. And when we actually look at them in comparison to other active treatments, there may actually not even be benefits. And a recent study that actually was just done in the UK of over 8,000 school children, actually found in that case that the kids who got the mindfulness program actually got worse. So they started to have new problems compared to people that just got standard socio-emotional learning.
Nick, what could be the cause of that? You know, in the first study that you mentioned, the 45 minutes and, you know, 8 days, et cetera, like really, really intensive mindfulness, it had benefits. What could potentially be the problem with, you know, this study with the school kids that are not, you know, practicing for as long or as intensively? Well,
part of the problem sort of is a lot of this stuff probably takes time, right? And sort of the way that this stuff gets marketed, and you mentioned at the head here at the beginning, sort of that, you know, the mindfulness space is part of this trillion-dollar wellness industry. And so there's this huge push to say, you know, do it for 5 minutes and you'll be right. You know, like that's all you need. Download the app, 5 minutes, you're good. You know, and they kind of often operate in this idea. I often joke about it's kind of like a gym membership, right? The gym is the best off if you sign up at the beginning of the year and you go once, they don't have to pay the maintenance fees if you keep going. But the reality is sort of similar to the gym is that if you don't actually keep doing it, if you don't practice it, it's unlikely to have any kind of lasting benefits to you. And so the reality sort of is that that kind of longer program, that 8-week program, is probably more likely to be beneficial because people actually get to practice and they get to try it out and they get troubleshooting. So when it's really not working for them, or when they're struggling with it, or when bad things come up, they have more opportunities to chat with someone about, well, what do I do with that? How do I make this work? Whereas if you're only doing it sort of for 5 minutes a few times, it's a lot harder for you to practice it out or practice the technique. And you oftentimes, along with those programs, you don't necessarily have access to anyone who can help you troubleshoot it. And when I start to talk about the kind of the negative side, the conclusion of the particular study I mentioned in the UK, it is this issue of kind of where awareness of an issue sometimes makes the issue worse, because you're making people aware of the fact that there may be a problem, but then you're not necessarily giving them the resources to address that problem.
Right.
Nick, I find that when I try, you know, I've done it in person with someone showing me how to do it, and also with several apps. And I find when I start an app, I'm in a critical sort of mind. I'm starting to think, oh, is this working for me? Is this not working for me? Which I'm not necessarily in if I'm doing it in a facilitated course or something like that. And I'm wondering if that's part of the problem as well, if we sort of approach these apps with a different mental attitude.
Yeah, look, I think, I mean, if you go somewhere to do something, right, and we know increasingly from research that the group element of it, you know, often you go and do these things in a group, or you're going somewhere out in the world to do this with a person, that there's a big part of the benefits probably is connected to that. And as you said, you know, if you're going with a teacher, you probably booked an appointment, or you scheduled the time to go, maybe you're paying the person, you've had to potentially drive somewhere, there might be a whole other, you know, group of friends or colleagues or potentially like-minded people. And so there's a good chance that you're going to be a little bit more open to kind of just seeing what happens and seeing where it goes. I mean, you can't exactly get up and walk out in a huff, you know, in the first few minutes, particularly if you know the people there. Whereas with an app, part of the problem is, you know, it's on your phone, you might be in your living room, and it's really easy just to go, I don't like this, and to turn it off.
Yeah.
Right. Or, you know, maybe your employer suggested, hey, download this app, it'll really help with work stress. And you kind of get that point in the middle of your day where, like, I cannot stand this anymore. And you kind of go to open that app. And while the app is playing, emails are pinging you in the background of, you know, the situation at your work that is stressing you out in the first place. And you're kind of going, this just is not helping, you know? So it's just a lot easier, I think, to dismiss it and kind of just to push it aside and to be critical of it when you don't have the people around you or the teacher in front of you kind of reminding you to just take it step by step.
Absolutely. We're chatting with Nicholas Van Dam, Associate Professor and Director of Contemplative Studies Centre at Melbourne University, about mindfulness and mental health. Nick, you know, I think that that's so true, because I know as well, like yoga, for example, which is all about mindfulness and, you know, focusing on your breath and taking your time. During lockdowns, I would do yoga in my lounge room and I just would stop. Like, I would just not, I would just be like, I don't want to do this today. But when you're in a class, of course, there's, you know, that mentality of like, everyone's around me, even though we're not supposed to be focusing on each other, they're going to know if I go into a child's pose. Like, that's, you know, I don't want to embarrass myself. So you keep doing it. And I imagine it is the same with, you know, meditation apps and mindfulness apps, because you do have that really easy out, which is just to shut your phone. But could, if you are the one that, you know, made the choice to get the app and you know that you're going to commit to, I don't know, 5, 10, 15 minutes a day, is there benefit to us merely just slowing our brains down for a moment?
Yeah, look, there can be. And I think if you were, I mean, one of the things sort of that we notice is sort of, we don't have tons of data on this, but there is suggestion that if you actually stick with it, it's actually likely to be beneficial. And so one of the biggest findings sort of out of this big school kid study in the UK with over 8,000 school kids was that, you know, I mean, probably, you know, as a no-brainer, as some people have said to me, is the kids in particular that really did do the program, that really kind of practiced on their own, they actually did benefit a reasonable amount, whereas the kids who didn't really do it were the ones that benefited the least, which again, sounds like a no-brainer. But the reality is, you know, it's really hard to stick with this stuff. It's really hard to stick with these practices. That doesn't mean that, you know, we shouldn't, or we should throw them all away, or we should give up on them. And to the, to, you know, quite to the contrary, I think if you actually can stick with the program and you can find tricks and tips and ways of actually doing it, it actually can be really beneficial for you. But I guess one point I'd like to make is but it's not necessarily true for everyone.
Yeah.
You know, for some people in particular, this is not the right thing to do. And a particularly, I think, relevant story, I have a close colleague who was in the process of transitioning and was engaging in a lot of yoga. And, you know, the yoga created more bodily awareness when there was some really, really strong body dysmorphia, right?
Yeah.
So that's a great example of where this is not the time to do the practice. You know, when you're really struggling with your physical identity not matching with your felt identity, that's probably not a time for you to sort of hone in on who you are. And so it may be, you know, for that individual, it may be that well, later on at a different time, they might want to go back and give it a try. But it may also be that it's just not the right thing for them.
Nick, I wonder if we're talking about the apps themselves, if you actually go and subscribe to an app and you do pay a fee, I wonder if that makes a difference because you are making that commitment, aren't you? And then you think, okay, well, I might as well do it because I want to get value.
There is some suggestion in kind of the economics literature that sort of people will be more committed to things that they pay for than things that they get for free. But, you know, we can also think about sort of all the people that have gym memberships, you know, and how often they actually go to the gym, right? And, you know, the wonderful thing about gym memberships from their perspective is that you pay the year-long fee up front. And, you know, whether you go or not, they don't care. Mm. So my suspicion sort of is that it probably makes a little bit of a difference, but probably not enough of a difference to really have an impact. The things that seem to really make an impact are things like PACs, you know, or social pressure in a good way, right? When people like post online, okay, I'm going to try meditation out for the next 3 months. And, you know, I'm going to post every day that I do it. And, you know, and then people around them will start to expect, well, hey, you didn't post anything. And it's even just that sense of like, well, people are monitoring whether or not I'm doing it. I've made this commitment. Or, similar to sort of going in a group, right? If you were to say in a group, or even like you could even just get a group of friends and say, we're going to download this app and we're going to do it. And if you were somehow accountable to that group, even just knowing that you might have to tell your friend whether or not you did it, those are the kinds of things that can make a really big difference.
Absolutely. Nick, before we let you go, could you tell us about the Contemplative Studies Center and as its inaugural director, what do you want to achieve with it?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I mean, so the center was founded in 2020 with this wonderful and amazing philanthropic gift from Mr. Martin Hosking, the former CEO of Redbubble. And our really big goal is to promote authentic contemplative practices. And we're really wanting things that are beyond just mindfulness, beyond meditation. So we're wanting to talk about things like going for a walk out bush, doing yoga practices, sitting down and connecting with your body, or even, you know, finding ways of sort of connecting with, you know, yourself, the broader universe, the planet, or any kind of deity that may be important to you while you're gardening or whatever else, right? So all practices are sort of kind of open game, but they need to be authentic. So we want them to be being promoted not just for people to make money, but for the greater good. We're committed to actually allowing for discussions and dialogues with a broad variety of communities. We feel that a lot of these traditions and techniques and ideas have been co-opted and commercialized in a way that sort of has been very unhelpful to a lot of people. And many of the people for whom they've been very important have not been involved in the ongoing conversations. And so as a result, you know, you get mindfulness for socioeconomically disadvantaged individuals, and they haven't really had any say in how the programs were developed, as an example. And then the last thing is that it's really critical to us that there's evidence when, particularly when we talk about rolling out mindfulness or meditation or other programs in schools, in healthcare, we really want to see good, rigorous evidence that suggests that that's what we ought to be doing. And as the mindfulness in school study that I mentioned just suggests, you know, in Australia, we're rolling out mindfulness across schools, you know, basically in a third or more of our schools. And that study just suggested that maybe we don't have that evidence. Maybe we shouldn't be mandating that kids do mindfulness. Maybe it should be a tailored thing where some kids get it and some kids get something else. And so that's something that as a center, we're really keen on trying to work with to produce that evidence to help advise people, when are these practices right for you? And then how do you do them? How do you actually figure out what will work for you? And how do you get in touch with a group that can actually support you through that practice?
Fantastic, Nicholas. Thank you so much for joining us on Joy Drive.
My pleasure.
That's Nicholas Van Dam, Associate Professor and Director of the Contemplative Studies Centre at Melbourne University. And for more info, you can head to nicholastvandam.com.
Joy Drive. Smart, fun radio.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.